From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. In 1877, Thomas Edison invented the phonograph. With it came, of course, recording. People then dreamed of talking books in their ears. Now, audiobooks are the fastest-growing format in publishing. In 1997, Jeremy Irons lent his voice to Nabokov's classic Lolita. Listeners could not stop listening. It became one of the most iconic audiobooks of all time.
Lolita, light of my life, fire of my loins, my sin, my soul. Lolita, the tip of the tongue taking a trip of three steps down the palate.
Okay, this hour on Point, the rise and now reign of audio books. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you addicted to audio books? What voices hook you in? When do you read a book? And when do you listen? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from London is Matthew Rubery, professor of modern literature in the School of English and Drama at Queen Mary University in London. He's authored the new book, The Untold Story of the Talking Book. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Matt Rubery, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
And with us from Portland, Maine, is Robin Witten. She's founder and editor of Audiophile, a magazine that reviews and recommends audiobooks. Robin, welcome.
Hello, Tom.
I knew audiobooks were popular. You see people listening to them all over the place these days, and always hearing from friends and family members looking for the next one. But their growth, Robin, is just outstripping, I guess, everything else in publishing right now. This is the hot thing.
It's exciting, and a lot of listeners, will be agreeing with you.
Why is that? Is it all about the fact that people, I don't know, they don't want to carry books anymore, they don't want to read as much, or it's so easy to have an audiobook on your smartphone? What's driving the popularity right now, Robin, of audiobooks?
Well, I think we're all pretty busy, and we're on the move, and there's never enough time to read. And so all of those books that you wish you had time to sit back and enjoy, you can take with you. And you can read while you're on the go, while you're doing daily chores or your commute or exercising, walking the dog. Lots of possibilities.
If we go all the way back, we've got that very early era of recording when people began to imagine entire books being recorded. Here's a little bit. You've got to listen very closely, but I think it's worth it. It's Alfred Lord Tennyson reading The Charge of the Light Brigade. This is recorded in 1890 on a phonograph made by Thomas Edison. Tennyson originally wrote this poem in December 1854. He recorded it 2 years before his death. Here he is reading the first stanza of The Charge of the Light Brigade, Alfred Lord Tennyson. Into the Valley of Death rode the 600. Matthew Rubery, that is not easy to listen to. If that were what we had today, I don't think audiobooks would be very popular. And yet, even at the beginning, people began to dream and imagine of something bigger, longer, more, Matthew.
That's right. I remember the first time I heard that recording, though. It still sent a shiver down my spine.
Half a league onward. It's amazing.
It's a very different reading style, too, from what we're used to now. It's very dramatic, whereas we tend to, anyone who goes to a poetry reading today will probably hear a very understated conversational style of reading.
When did the notion of books that would be recorded, entire books instead of snippets, begin to take hold, at least in the imagination or the anticipation, Matt?
Yeah, so I think Edison did predict that the phonograph would be used to record books, I mean, right away. He thought that you'd be recording an entire Dickens novel within a few years of inventing the phonograph. He was wildly optimistic, though, because it would take a few decades for the technology to make that possible. For the first 50 years, you could only record about 2 or 3 minutes of speech on a wax cylinder on a disc. And that meant you could sort of record short poems like Tennyson's or, let's say, a speech from Shakespeare, things like that. But nothing closer to a full-length recording of a novel. That didn't stop people, though, from imagining what shape the book of the future would take. And people really thought that, or a number of people really thought, that recorded books would replace printed books and would be much easier to use and much more enjoyable.
And now here we are, 2016. Audiobook of the year was author Paula Hawkins' The Girl on the Train. Here's a little bit of Claire Corbett narrating for the book's character, Rachel.
I've been thinking about Jess all day, unable to focus on anything but what I saw this morning. What was it that made me think that something was wrong? I couldn't possibly see her expression at that distance, but I felt when I was looking at her that she was alone. More than alone. Lonely. Perhaps she was.
And there it is. They haven't always been called audiobooks. It was talking books at the beginning, Matt. And World War I had a lot to do with people really putting their shoulder to the task of making these a reality. Why and how, Matt?
That's right. I think the return of blinded soldiers from the First World War really gave a push to developing this technology. There weren't that many blinded soldiers in America, but the image of the soldier's wounded body was really effective in fundraising for a talking book library. And people felt very strongly that there needed to be some way for these soldiers to relax and enjoy themselves and still be able to read. Most soldiers who came back couldn't learn to read Braille. It's very difficult to read, to learn Braille if you've lost your sight midlife. Only about 20% of blind readers can read Braille. So that meant the other 80% didn't have any way of reading. This was a way for soldiers to read independently and not be dependent on other people to help them relax.
What was the form of those early talking books, as they called them?
Yeah, the first talking books were made on 12-inch records. They were a slower speed than the previous records. So most records were 78 revolutions per minute. And the first talking books slowed all the way down to 33 and a third revolutions per minute. And that enabled them to record about 15 minutes on each disc and to send these discs then through the mail. And people could then sit back, listen to these books at home, and then ship them back in the mail when they were done with them.
That's a lot of discs, 15 minutes at a time to get through a significant book. The first, is it true, the first one was Helen Keller work or the Bible or both, Matt?
Yeah, the very first recording was the romantic poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge's The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. Hmm. And the people who started the program wanted to do something notable for the first recording. But literature and fiction were a bit controversial since the Talking Book Library received government funding and not everyone wanted to pay for entertainment, especially books that had controversial material in them. So I think the real emphasis of the first recordings were the Bible, patriotic documents like the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution, and historical books as well. And there was that real emphasis on trying to make sure the funding for the program wasn't jeopardized.
It goes back very often to this issue of whether listening to a book is the same as reading a book. If you've listened to a book, have you read the book? And people get in big debates about this, Matt. I understand you've heard those debates. Those debates might have gotten you interested in the subject in the first place.
That's right. I mean, I started this research because a friend of mine came up to me, was very excited to tell me that he'd read a book recently. And then all of a sudden he backtracked and apologized and said, well, he didn't actually read it. He'd listened to it. And I thought that was strange because it seems to me that listening to a book is one of the only forms of reading for which people apologize. And I wanted to sort of investigate the roots of that shame. Why do people feel that way? I mean, most people talk about reading a book as a personal achievement. And then sort of poking around in this history, I realized it went much further back than I realized and that it was a much more interesting one than I realized because it was full of these controversies and impassioned debates about what it means to read a book in the first place.
Robin, if I've listened to a book on tape, if I've listened to an audiobook, have I read the book?
I think so. I think it's the same. It's a learning and listening experience that you've taken it in an auditory way. It's different for different learning styles, though, and you know, some people do better listening to a book than having to read it with their eyes. They absorb differently. And it's an experience that a lot of people are gaining confidence in. It's very interesting what you said, Matt.
I've gone through periods where I could not stop listening to audiobooks and then periods where I listened to none at all. You get the right narrator and they can be really compelling. Barbara Rosenblatt, household name in the world of audiobooks, UK-born, has recorded over 400 titles, maybe best known for ability to precisely inhabit different accents. Recorded, won 8 Audio Awards. It's the Audio Book Award given by the Audio Publishers Association. Here's a little bit of her iconic reading of Helen Fielding's Bridget Jones' diary.
"Bridget," crowed Una Auchinbury, "we'd almost given you up for lost. Happy New Year. Just about to start without you."
"Bridget, Happy New Year," said Geoffrey Auchinbury. "Come on, let's get you a drink. How's your love life, anyway?"
"Oh, God. Why can't married people understand that this is no longer a polite question to ask? We wouldn't rush up to them and roar, 'How's your marriage going? Still having sex?'"
Robin Witten, it's so intimate, this experience of listening. And you, right away, you either sort of like the narrator or you don't, I guess. I mean, but it is intimate. They are going to interpret the book for you right there next to your brain.
Right, right. They're in your ear. They're right with you telling this story.
But does that make them a co-author in a way? There's so much interpretation going on in the reading of an audiobook.
I think so, but they also, you know, many of them channel what they interpret the author's intent to be, just like a performance of music or any other kind of performance. They are interpreting the intent of the author through the words in a dramatic performance.
That's a lot of power, Matt Rubery. I mean, if an author has a voice in their work, so does the narrator, a literal voice when it comes to audiobook.
And that's right. I mean, a lot of people complain that the narrator intrudes between the printed page and the reader. For some people, that's a problem. But like Robin said, I think a lot of the best narrators are like film actors, where you're sort of aware of them and listen to books read by your favorite narrator again and again, but also at the same time see them in the role of a character that you can sort of immerse yourself in. I've read a lot of fan mail to narrators. People just do have very passionate relationships to these voices, and they can't get enough of them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about books in our ears this hour, the surging popularity of audiobooks, what's driving it, and the history of what was once called the talking book. With me this hour, Matthew Rubery. He's author of The Untold Story of the Talking Book. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Professor of Modern Literature in the School of English and Drama at Queen Mary University in London. Robin Witten is with us from Portland, Maine, editor and founder of Audiophile, magazine that reviews and recommends audiobooks, audio programs, spoken word programs. You can join us as well. Are you an audiobook nut? Are you addicted to audiobooks? How do they get their hooks into you? What's the unique allure of getting lost in a good audiobook? What makes the magic? And when do you read a book? And when do you listen? For that matter, where do you listen? In the car, at the laundromat, before bed, on the train? Let's hear a little bit from George Guidel, recorded over 900 books over the course of his 20-year career as an audiobook narrator. Think about it. Smooth, smoky voice, even-paced speech gained him a big fan base. Here's a recent example from his narration of Daniel Silva's 2016 novel, The Black Widow, book 6 in her Gabriel Allon spy series.
Though Paul Rousseau did not know it then, the seeds for just such an operational union had already been sown. For on that very same evening, as Rousseau was walking toward his sad little bachelor's apartment on the Rue Saint-Jacques, a car was speeding along Beirut's seafront corniche. The car was black in color, German in manufacture, and imposing in size.
And we're in to the audiobook there with George Guidel. Robin Witten, what makes a good narrator? And what's the range of styles that you hear?
Oh, there are so many styles. I mean, we just heard two examples of a highly characterized performance by Barbara Rosenblatt with many of the
Bridget
character
Jones.
Voices
yep.
and the mm-hmm. Bridget Jones. And then George Guidel with the Daniel Silva, you know, he's in the narrative. So you're seeing the black car and the other elements of the story. And in that part, it's much more subtle. There's a huge range in the wonderful actors that are audiobook narrators and make that their career, you know, between the styles of lots of characters, lots of emotional connection. It really depends on what they're reading, because some books demand it and others really don't.
We heard at the top of the hour from Jeremy Irons reading Lolita. What was it about that reading that so shook up this world and maybe changed the course of audiobooks a bit and narration?
Well, it seems like, I mean, just that little bit that you you excerpted, it was suddenly I'd forgotten how much you suddenly hear the word. I mean, you hear the words. That's obvious. But he was giving us something more than just the written word, the emotional intent in that in the work. And it was, I mean, it just speaks right to you.
Yeah, definitely.
Grabs
and
you.
So much attitude in it. And the actor bringing all the acting to bear. And then, of course, there's been the trend of authors themselves really getting in there. Toni Morrison has been very active. One of the first big publisher recordings for the commercial market. She did herself, The Song of Solomon, and considered one of the great audiobooks. Here she is reading from the 1986 recording.
The singing woman wore a knitted navy cap pulled far down over her forehead. She had wrapped herself up in an old quilt instead of a winter coat. Her head cocked to one side, her eyes fixed on Mr. Robert Smith, she sang in a powerful contralto, "Oh, sugar man, done fly away. Sugar man done gone. Sugar man cut across the sky. Sugar man gone home." A few of the half a hundred or so people gathered there nudged each other and sniggered. Others listened as though it were the helpful and defining piano music in a silent movie.
A much younger Toni Morrison than the Toni Morrison we've talked with recently, but preserved beautifully right there. I mean, Matt Ruberry, what about this development of authors themselves getting into the business of reading their books for tape, for audio?
I've got tremendous respect for Toni Morrison for reading audiobooks when it wasn't very fashionable. I mean, it was still sort of a lowbrow format then, and there weren't many authors who recorded their own books. I think that has changed now, and a lot of authors do like reading their own books. Some are very good at it. Toni Morrison's one. Authors like John le Carré, Neil Gaiman, Stephen King, or others who are very good at reading their own work. But in general, I don't think the author is the best person to read their own work. I mean, there's some atrocious readings out there, too. I think it's a real skill to be able to narrate a book and sort of decide where to put the inflection and emphasis. And authors are usually much more comfortable with the written word than the spoken word. I mean, having said that, though, I think people who are skeptics of audiobooks still don't really mind an author reading their own work because it seems appropriate that they could make decisions how the book should sound, whereas they might have problems with an actor making those decisions instead of the reader.
They were called talking books. They were called spoken word recordings. In the 1970s, I guess the cassette tape comes along, and that's huge, books on tape suddenly. And then the 1990s, suddenly we're calling them audio books. What's behind the evolution of the nomenclature here, Matt?
I think there was just a lot of confusion for the first few decades that audiobooks were out there. So they were called talking books and then recorded books, books on tape. If you go to a bookstore today, you might still see a shelf labeled books on tape, but
no tape involved.
Books on compact discs and things like that. And it wasn't until 1994, I think, when the Audio Publishers Association decided that they needed to have one single term because it was so confusing and decided on audiobooks. So in some ways, when you use the term audiobook, you mean it as a catch-all for all these different formats. But historically, people didn't have a single term until the 90s.
And now so many formats. And of course, the digital download realm is enormous. We'll look at that. Lots of callers for the two of you. Matt and Robin, please stand by. Steve in Mandeville, Louisiana. Steve, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
How's it going, guys?
Very well. What's your experience with audiobooks, Steve?
Well, I'm 62 years old. I've been blind since I was five.
Okay.
So I got into the talking books in probably 1960. And they would be sent to you from the state library, and you'd listen on a 33 and a third record and
wow,
pack them up and send them back. But I was telling your screener that the Braille, a good Braille reader reads about 30 words a minute. And a Braille, like, for example, the dictionary takes up, well, each letter would be in a book that would be about 8.5 by 11 by 5 inches thick.
Just
the sheer volume of Braille is ridiculous. That's why very few people use it anymore. But I worship the books, and I love you. I pulled up George Guidel. Another one of my favorites is Will Patton. I love the when these two guys read. But their voices, it's amazing that it'll be George Guidel will be doing a woman, and he doesn't really change to a falsetto, but my Lord, I know who that woman is,
mm-hmm.
you know, just by his inflection, and he's definitely one of the best.
What has it meant for you, Steve, those years
literacy.
To have this this huge horizon opened up of audiobooks?
Literacy.
Yeah.
You know, literally, literacy. My wife and I joke because she's sighted. She can read, you know, she laughs. She can leave the light on while I am sleeping. I read with a thing in my ear.
Yes.
You know, when we're in bed. We said the perfect couple would be if she was deaf, so that I could listen to mine without the earplug, and she could read, you know. But it's spectacular. I can hardly sleep at night if I don't have a book to read.
Blind, but not blind in this realm whatsoever. I wonder what has most grabbed you. I was so addicted for a while, way back to Patrick O'Brien's Aubrey Maturin series, you know, The Master Commander and all that. Steve, what has addicted you?
I'll tell you a great story. The library here, we have a radio station here in New Orleans called WRBH, which reads to the blind and print handicap, and it's just on FM. But when we used to go to the library, we had a woman turn my wife onto this new series of books that's coming out called Harry Potter.
And yeah, we've heard of it, I guess.
She gave her a copy of it, and I listened to, like, the first CD and said, Susan, this is children's books, you know, and she said, oh, well, so I got finished what she had gotten me at the library and went on and put it on, and I was hooked. You know, I listened to every Harry Potter book, can't stand the movies because they don't cover the topic, you know, but I am a voracious reader, and strictly because of audio.
Steve, I absolutely love it. And cutting right through the blindness, never mind it. You've got the audiobook there for you, and thank you for sharing that joy in it. It's very interesting how things get read and read in different countries with Harry Potter. Of course, Matt, you're there in London, and Robin, as you know, there were different narrators, I guess, for the American and the British versions, Robin?
Absolutely. I think in this country, Jim Dale did the American versions, who is British, but again, they were recorded here, did a magnificent job. And in the UK, I think Stephen Fry did. So both are very well known. Both have slightly different styles, but fans, we could have people arguing about that.
Let's listen to that. We have those back to back here just to see how that was presented to its sort of home country, British audience, and then to the American audience. This was Stephen Fry narrating for the UK audience. Deep timbre, long phrasings to sort of capture the darkness of the Harry Potter series. Here are Fry's opening lines to the 1999 audio recording of Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone.
Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of number 4 Privet Drive were proud to say that they were perfectly normal, thank you very much. They were the last people you'd expect to be involved in anything strange or mysterious, because they just didn't hold with such nonsense.
Okay, there's the British version, Stephen Fry, for British listeners to Harry Potter. In the U.S., it was Jim Dale. It's kind of more exaggerated, sometimes comedic tone, added some sarcasm to the series, won 2 Grammys for his Harry Potter performances. Here he is, carrying right on with 1999's Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone.
Mr. Dursley was the director of a firm called Grunnings, which made drills. He was a big, beefy man with hardly any neck, although he did have a very large moustache. Mrs. Dursley was thin and blonde and had nearly twice the usual amount of neck, which came in very useful as she spent so much of her time craning over garden fences, spying on the neighbors.
Okay, I mean, I hear those two. Matt, I'm not sure why you'd choose one for the UK audience and another for the US audience. Is it clear to you, Matthew?
Oh, I think it is a copyright issue or something like that. You can't purchase both narrators. In the US, you can only get Jim Dale, and in the UK, you can only get Stephen Fry. But I'd love to see us reach a point where people can choose their narrators, and a book would have multiple versions, and you could compare each version, you know, listen to samples, and decide which narrator fits your preferences best and what makes one reading better than another, and sort of get beyond this debate about whether audiobooks count as real reading or not.
Just go. Doug in Peaks Island, Maine. Doug, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I have been an absolute devotee and dependent on audiobooks of various forms for decades before there actually were any audiobooks, because I'm an illustrator working at home, often long hours and totally isolated. And way back when, decades ago, I started with my library vinyl recordings of Cademan Arts and Listening Arts, or Spoken Arts. I forget which of the label were, but they were my introduction to spoken word other than what you could get on the radio.
Yeah.
And a wide variety of things. Fortunately, my library was great, and it really helps me to this day. Working late at night, you know, it often keeps me going, much like people can't put down a book and go to sleep. Sometimes I'm up till 1 o'clock in the morning because one more desk, you know, one more desk. I can't go to sleep, and it keeps me working at my desk.
Can you get lost in the narration and do your illustration at the same time? What if they're about very divergent subjects, Doug?
Well, they are. They're always divergent subjects. And I have to confess, one of the issues that you touched on was whether or not, you know, reading and listening is a different experience. I have to confess that much as I love audiobooks, sometimes, I mean, I'm basically doing rendering, which, you know, I'm not making big decisions at that point. I can't listen to the audiobooks if I'm doing conceptual work, the sketch work. But when I'm doing the rendering, it's just kind of grunt work in a way. But little decisions have to be made, and then I'll miss something, you know, and then I'll realize that I missed something, and I'll either just, you know, review on a little bit to hear, oh, okay, what was that? Or I'll listen to that track again, and occasionally I'll have the feeling that I've missed too much when I've finished an audiobook, and I'll listen to it again, or I'll listen to that disc again when I feel I was a little too distracted. So it definitely is a different experience than reading. But I got to say, at my age, audiobooks are the only way that I read, because any time I read, it's generally getting in bed late at night, and I'm out in about two pages. So I get through far more reading with audiobooks. And going all the way back, I still have my old spoken arts and listening arts records that I collected years ago that were wonderful and were such a varied type, because at the time, I mean, because when it was they were on vinyl, very few were unabridged recordings. They were usually excerpts. Mm-hmm. I had excerpts of things as wide as kind of history things, like I remember Bertrand Russell's Nobel Prize acceptance speech from the 50s, which was wonderful, and the Army McCarthy hearings, obviously an excerpt, and excerpts from John Steinbeck reading Johnny Bear short stories with his own voice, which is pretty exceptional, and listening to plays, Zoo Story, Albee, Don Juan in Hell, Shaw. And
your audio library is deep, Doug. It's deep. Respect to it. I see how it can keep you up illustrating all night. I mean, some very straight narrations there. These days, a lot have more theatrical presentation. Here's a dramatic full cast production of Rudyard Kipling's The Jungle Book. It's in theaters this year, also on tape this year. Much more theatrical. Won the 2016 Audie Award for Best Audio Drama.
When Hathi the elephant, who lives for 100 years and more, saw a long blue ridge of rock show dry in the very center of the stream, he knew that he was looking at Peace Rock. He lifted up his trunk and proclaimed, as his father before him had proclaimed a generation earlier,
"What's happening, Baloo?"
No, Robin Witten, caw, caw, tukey, tukey. There we are with all kinds of side effects. Is that the new wave? Is that where it's going? Or is it just for kids?
No, I think there's a lot of creative opportunity in some of the soundscapes that are coming in some of the dramatized performances. I think that's a great way to lead people into audiobooks and maybe bridge the gap between not knowing whether they're wanting to listen to a single voice in a book, or being entranced by getting some of the sound effects and music and a little more drama.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Blue Apron. providing pre-portioned, fresh ingredients with easy recipes delivered to your door. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping at blueapron.com/onpoint. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about books in our ears, the surging popularity of audiobooks, what's driving it, and the history of what was once called the talking book. My guests are Matthew Rubery, he's author of the new book, The Untold Story of the Talking Book, and Robin Witten, with us from Portland, Maine. Matt is in London. Robin is editor and founder of Audiophile, magazine reviews and recommends audiobooks and audio programs. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Is listening to a book equal to reading a book? Is it reading a book? What do you love listening to? The classics, one genre, one author, one narrator? Do you like to hear the author in their own words, reading their own works? Last year, narrator Bonnie Turpin won the Audie Award for Best Female Solo Narration for her recording of Lila Ibrahim's novel Yellow Crocus. Here she is at the awards ceremony talking about how, as a narrator of audiobooks, she prepares for the role.
Well, I read the book. And while I read the book, I look for different characters and where I'm going to need to differentiate voices and who the people are, basically. And, you know, I don't do usually a lot of research about the time period or anything because I'm going to read the book. I'm not going to tell any story that's not in the book.
Turpin's known for her authentic accent, sensitive, kind of deliberate pacing. Her recording of Colson Whitehead's 2016 bestseller, The Underground Railroad, was also a winner of an Audiophile's Earphone Award this year. This week, the novel itself won the National Book Award for Fiction. But here's a clip of Turpin's narration.
It was going to be a memorable birthday if folks were already this riled.
If you could pick your birthday, what would it be? Lovey asked. Cora couldn't see Lovey's face for the sun behind her, but she knew her friend's expression. Lovey was uncomplicated, and there was going to be a celebration that night.
It only takes a half a minute, and we're in it. Cheryl in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. Cheryl, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I just wanted to comment how much my family, as a family, we enjoyed audiobooks, especially when we went traveling. We did a lot of road trips all over the country, and I have two boys. They're 21 and 18 now, but this was probably the time when they were in their 11 and 12, and we listened to tons of books in our travels, and I'm telling you, it was wonderful. We listened to The Last Apprentice series by Joseph Delaney, who he's the author, and it was wonderful. It made the miles go by fast on some of those really long, boring roads, and it was really good for my kids.
And maybe a kind of gift to your children, Cheryl. You know, I remember as a young boy, my mother would put on long albums, record albums of books or portions of books when my brother and I would fall asleep in the bunk beds. And I remember listening to those and again and again, and the pacing and the rhythm and the language that they use, Cheryl. For a child, it sinks in very deep.
Oh, yes, it did. It was wonderful. And, I mean, my boys, I read to them even when they were a little bit older, and they always enjoyed that. But, of course, I'm not as good as the ones that do it, you know, for a job. So the ones we listened to were great. And one of the other ones I wanted to mention was we listened to Inkheart, and Brendan Fraser, the actor, he actually was in the movie, and then he did actually the recording.
Yeah.
And I really was thinking, oh, I bet this isn't going to be that good. But he did a fantastic job reading. Really, really excellent. Really had us hooked. So that was another one we really enjoyed.
Inkheart, that brings back another time. I appreciate your call, Cheryl. I mean, Matt, how does it work with narrators now? Where are most of them doing their work? I know some who just do it at home. They make it their own studio. They get the book. Off they go.
Yeah, I should add in response to Cheryl that I had a family trip not long ago with a long car ride and have small kids and got caught without any audiobooks, and it was the longest ride of my life. So
get
I never made
the
that
audiobooks
mistake again.
For crying out loud.
Yeah, I think there are big changes in the audio industry right now. I mean, the Audible, who's the largest distributor of audiobooks today, has really expanded the market for audio recordings, but they've also driven down costs, and I think that's made it a lot tougher for a number of audiobook producers to add a sort of editing component to the experience, a sort of a level of quality control. Huh. And a lot of actors now do these recordings in their home studios or on their own without any oversight. So in some ways, there's a risk that we'll get more audiobooks than ever before, but not necessarily better quality ones. And I'm hoping that doesn't happen.
Robin, what about that? Audible, of course, is all about downloading, and that's driving numbers like crazy, the number of books that are available as audiobooks, and also maybe has a lot to do with how popular they're becoming because of the ease of it. What about the quality as it goes out to, you know, somebody nails some foam up on the wall of their bathroom and records? Is that all right?
Well, I don't think that's all right. and I think that does a disservice to the many narrators who have really high-level professional studios within their homes. I mean, the availability of high-quality sound equipment and microphones that can be and booths that can be made within homes is where, you know, the real professionals are working. And I think one of the difficult things is that it's all years ago when performers were more often in studios with engineers and directors, there was oversight and there was a certain interplay of another ear and
yeah, somebody and listening someone, and so, yeah, you know, what worked and what didn't.
Right. And so now it's all a lot on the narrator. They have to – can they hear always when their voice is getting a little tired or, you know, maybe they have to do their own self-editing and self-directing, which is a big responsibility and it's hard. And
is there a way to know from the packaging or the way an audio book is presented how it's been recorded, whether in a studio with an editor or producer or just, you know, or out in a tent on a hillside?
No. Well, I think if it was in a tent on a hillside, you'd probably hear it, but not so much in the packaging. And of course, with digital downloads, there is no packaging. So even the studio engineers and people involved are not getting credit on often in the performances now. But I think that, you know, the audio publishers are concerned about the quality and they, you know, do as much as they can within the other constraints to do quality control and making sure that the sound is good and creates a good exciting experience for our
listeners. Going for that. Everybody's going for that. David in Williamsville, New York. David, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes. I hate to be a wet blanket and a stick in the mud.
Bring it, David. Bring it. Okay, we're bracing.
I'm going to go at you. I'm also blind, like the first caller.
Okay.
But I spent half my adult life sighted and read voraciously.
Great.
And then for the last 22 years, I've been forced to read audiobooks.
Right.
Experience audiobooks.
Mm-hmm.
Given the experiences with both, I mean, I truly believe an audiobook is better than nothing, but I would rather use my mind and a printed page to experience an author. Now, I read a book a week, but the difference between the two experiences, because I've experienced both, I think the printed page really is the preferred way. Now, in a car, obviously, you don't want to be driving and reading a printed page. But I do disagree that it's the same thing. I think the printed page engages the mind much more actively.
So deeper engagement, maybe more freedom, David, to imagine it as richly as you will.
Well, and for instance, I'd walk around with a book in my pocket, whereas I'm not going to be able to do the same thing with an audiobook. Even if it's an earbud, it's not the same as sitting on a bench waiting for the bus and reading a book as opposed to sitting on a bench listening to a book.
I mean, we know it's different, and yet it's interesting how we assess that difference. Matt Ruber, is this part of what... You said it was seen as lowbrow for a long time. Is it because people thought, you know, when you reduce it to a narration, voiced narration, you lose your own mind's freedom to richly, diversely imagine the author's work?
That's certainly a part of it. I mean, some people insist that vocalization or the act of Imagining what the words sound like in your mind is a key part of reading. And if you're not doing that, if you're allowing someone else to pronounce the words for you, mm-hmm. then you're sort of outsourcing the work.
And not only pronounce, but to invest them with meaning, voice, timbre, everything.
Yeah, but I don't necessarily think that all readers are that passive when they listen to these stories. I mean, you can sort of push back against these readings and disagree and think about how you would have read a line differently. But I think it's absolutely right to point out that, you know, even within the blind community, there's a lot of disagreement about the validity of talking books. So a lot of Braille readers, for instance, feel strongly that Braille is a superior form of reading to talking books because you're sort of actively sounding out those words for yourself.
Here's a reader you might recognize reading the opening paragraphs back in 2005 of a book written in 1995, Dreams from My Father.
A few months after my 21st birthday, a stranger called to give me the news. I was living in New York at the time, on 94th between 2nd and 1st, part of that unnamed shifting border between East Harlem and the rest of Manhattan. The line was thick with static. Betty? Betty, is this you? Yes, who's this? Yes, Betty, this is your Aunt Jane in Nairobi. Can you hear me? I'm sorry, who'd you say you were? Aunt Jane, listen, Betty, your father is dead. He's killed in a car accident. Hello, can you hear me? I say your father is dead. Barry, please call your uncle in Boston and tell him. I can't talk now, okay, Barry? I will call you again. That was all.
Of course, Barack Obama reading from his Dreams from My Father, 1995, about a very intense moment in his personal history, is something really to think about now after he's been, now after all these years as president. That is real sharing there in the voice and words of the author, Robin. Do you think he's got a future in audiobook narration if he gets bored after the presidency?
Well, there probably is another book.
Yeah.
And we would want him to read it, wouldn't we?
He's got a pretty good voice, pretty darn good voice for narration there. Anna in Southwest Ranches, Florida. Anna, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My comment is more about comparing the two, that I think mm-hmm. they are both great experiences, but two different experiences, and I tend to pick which one I want. I think when I'm reading a printed book, it's akin to meditation in that to really grasp the book, you have to tune out interruptions, you have to really focus on it to the point that there's nothing else in your mind. It almost gives you a break from everything else. And then in your mind, you're creating the characters and how they found and the scenery and the rest of it and following the plot line. Whereas when it's an audio book, which I've also enjoyed, it's a different kind of enjoyment. I'm not putting the effort in of the reading and creating, so I'm not using as much of my own imagination. But when you hear how beautiful some of the narrations are, that's also its own experience. So for me, as kind of a late adopter to audio books, I hope they never go away. I sure hope the printed word never goes away either, yes. But I enjoy them both quite differently, and I'm sure glad that they're there now in broader circulation for the people that don't have the option.
Absolutely.
Reading the written word.
Well, I don't know why you wouldn't. Well, if you're blind, you wouldn't have the option. I mean, it's interesting. People go back and forth. We had the author, Com Tobini, he was talking to the Wall Street Journal last year and said that reading a novel rather than listening to an audiobook is, quoting him, like the difference between running a marathon and watching a marathon on TV. I don't know if it's that stark, but then there's a recent email reported here in the Journal again. He said that he had tossed that off as a kind of a glib mood. And he said, I really believe in the slow, solitary, silent business of reading. He said, an audiobook is a kind of performance, like a radio play on a long car journey. I can't think of anything better. But it doesn't, he said, replace reading. Diane in Fort Collins, Colorado. Diane, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I guess I would agree with some of the idea of reading as a marathon. I have a 16-year-old son who's dyslexic, and being able to get through a book is a marathon for him. And without audiobooks, and in particular an organization called Learning Ally that has audiobooks with a read-along app, he wouldn't ever be able to get through the rigorous high school curriculum he's in. He's in an international baccalaureate program, and they read things like Mark Twain and Dostoevsky and Paper Towns and heavy-duty textbooks.
Yeah.
And something like that has really enabled him to achieve at a level that he would never be able to do without audiobooks. So I'm all for them and agree with a lot of your callers.
That's a joyful thing for a dyslexic young man to be able to have all that literary range through the audiobook, and we celebrate it with you, Diane. Edward, one more here in Boston. Edward, our time is short, but you are on, sir.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Hi. I've been doing audiobooks for over 10 years, probably over 600 titles, and obviously a real convert. It's given me a literary life. I'm kind of a ponderous reader, so you don't have to be blind to appreciate the advantages in terms of the volume of work you can cover with audiobooks in your time. And, you know, again, different experiences. You could be distracted listening to audiobooks, but then you listen to it again. I commonly start each book with by listening the first part three or four times so I get the characters straight and set the stage, and then I'm good for going through continuously.
Wow, Edward, you're a connoisseur, listening to the opening three or four times to catch the wavelength. Robin, what comes next? Now we've got digital downloads. There's just been this ongoing, as Matthew Ruberry reports, change in the technology that delivers these. Is there something after the digital download? Is it going to be, I don't know, in my spectacles or
well,
on my earlobe?
It may well be, but it'll make it more portable, won't it be?
Why are they so expensive, Robin? The downloads, $60 sometimes. Do they make a killing on these?
I don't think so. I think that that's, you know, that has to do with the rights a lot, and not necessarily just having a lot of savings in the production expense. You know, libraries still have a lot of audiobooks. They're available as downloads, and they are free.
Yeah, good to remember. And, of course, we want the authors and we want the narrators to get something for their work. Absolutely. This has been fun. Robin Witten in Portland, Maine, editor and founder of Audiophile. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Matt Ruberry, author of the new book, The Untold Story of the Talking Book, with us from London. Matthew Ruberry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Roll on. This is On Point.